Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
60 seconds of video from the Mexican border will show you Customs and Border Protection patrol officers have high-stress jobs. Well, they're not alone. Lots of CBP jobs bring stress, and stress brings the potential for mental health problems in the workforce. For how the agency deals with mental health, we turn to the operational psychologist in CBP's Workforce Operations Division, Joshua Tomchessen. Dr. Tomchessen, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate you giving us an opportunity to talk.
And in general, I mean, yes, Border Patrol officers are dealing with a difficult situation in a public spotlight, but lots of jobs have stress. And I guess let's start with, you know, the tempo of work and what the stressors are that bring people to the brink of possible mental health problems beyond the ordinary requirement that you have to do a job and make a living.
Absolutely. First of all, if you would have asked me this question a year ago before I started with CBP, I probably would have had a much smaller, more refined answer here. But as I've been in the organization, one of the things that I've come to realize is that we have an awesome workforce of 64,000, 65,000 individuals, all doing different jobs day in and day out. My background is Department of Defense. I was a DOD guy. I would tell you that the DOD had it set up pretty nice, and they do a pretty good job, and they are working really hard. I would say the men and women of CBP do this day in and day out, not on a deployment. They're constantly working, and the stressors are very real. Everything from the men and women on the front lines, you know, checking IDs, making sure that our borders are safe, to those in the back offices, making sure that those individuals have what they need. There's a lot of unique stressors to this agency. The workforce, just like any other workforce, we have to work through and deal with it. And leadership is recognizing that we need to take care of our workforce.
I guess maybe one of the themes in stressful types of law enforcement or law enforcement related jobs, and this would go across many agencies, is you're dealing with other people, the public, when that public is under stress. I mean, you could say that of people crossing the border, but also people getting off airplanes or going through screening lines, in the case of your sister agency, TSA, and so on. Those people are already, to some degree, under stress, and that's where incidents can break out or personal insults can start flying.
Absolutely. It's a very unique circumstance when you're dealing with the public and public safety, right? So our men and women, especially those on the front lines, every day have to be able to separate their personal life from their professional life in order to give the best service that they can to the individuals. And whether that's somebody coming through one of the ports of entry or whether that's, you know, a traffic stop with local law enforcement, when we're talking about law enforcement in general, there's an added level of complexity of stress when you have to ignore your personal life while you're at work. And, you know, one of the things we know is that's not an easy task to do. Not to mention whatever's going on with the public in their personal life causes stress, right? So as a personal mantra, I always use, you never know what that person's going through, right? That's real easy to say when you're in a car driving down the street. It's another thing when you're confronted by four individuals who are very upset and want some sort of action from you. So it's a very unique set of circumstances for our first responders when they're confronted with these issues.
And getting to your office, Workforce Operations Division, what kinds of signals do you get for understanding the mental health potential problems in the workforce?
First, I should probably let you know, the Workforce Operations Division, we employ what we call field teams. As of right now, there's three full field teams, and we're trying to hire more. And that consists of an operational psychologist and a law enforcement individual who is a trained peer supporter chaplain right now. We call ourselves a field team. And we are what we would consider sensors on the ground within the field, going out, engaging with the men and women of the workforce, with management, talking through issues at various ports, stations, work centers, to try to assist the managers and employees in making a cultural shift right now. And what I mean by that is there's a high priority for the agency to put our people first. And while that's always been important, I don't know that that's always been at the forefront of what we were doing. And just based on the commissioner's recent goals, putting people first is high on that priority list. So, you know, the commissioner developed four specific goals. One of those is the workforce care, professionalism, and development. And we are looking for ways, boots on the ground, to be able to assist those in leadership positions doing that. Another one of his goals is to support operations. And with that, that's where the operational psychologist is a little bit different than a clinical psychologist. An operational psychologist's focus is on the organization as a whole. Now, that can be interacting with individuals, teams, leadership, or any of the combination, whereas a clinical psychologist is primarily focused on the patient.
We're speaking with Dr. Joshua Tomchesson, an operational psychologist in the Workforce Operations Division at Customs and Border Protection. And when does simply the normal stresses of a job devolve over into mental health problems? And then what can you do about that in such a way that the person is accepting of what it is they're actually going through and will take help? Because that's a cultural issue, too, I think.
Absolutely. One of the great things that the organization has done recently is they just put out a memorandum of understanding that was agreed upon by two of the unions and leadership to provide a safe harbor, as we call it, for individuals seeking care for mental health issues. And this outlines some basic responsibilities of both the employee and leadership in order to allow individuals to come forward when they need to take me. Really, when we talk about doing something like this, it's unique to our organization in that, you know, historically, we haven't had a culture that would allow such a thing. And now we have in writing the promise to the employee that we will do what we can to assist and take care of you. And that's a huge monumental undertaking. And it's a huge step forward in taking care of our workforce. As I was saying, one of the core values that we're trying to really get into is that leadership aspect of taking care of our people, because we recognize people are the mission.
Right. But for the federal workforce in general, the availability of EAPs, employee assistance plans, I think is pretty universal. What do you need to do beyond that in the CBP context? That's just not the EAP that everybody can access.
Sure. So EAP is a fantastic resource and has a lot of applicability. However, not everybody has access to EAP in our organization. We have individuals that are located 3 to 4 hours away from, you know, even a small city, let alone a city. So EAP is phenomenal, but they can't reach everybody. I think last I heard it was about 10% of folks that they can actually reach. So what we're working on are ways to assist the management in finding alternatives to EAP and or personal or insurance, you know, that type of thing, but also just kind of educating our leadership on what it means. Not everybody that's going through something would necessarily need, you know, a mental health provider per se, but that doesn't mean that it's still not affecting them and not affecting their work. So when we're talking about mental health in that regard, one of the focuses that I have as a performance enhancement individual is how do we keep high functioning individuals functioning at high levels? And we have that in this organization. And sometimes that is taking the proverbial knee for a little bit.
Is there a granular way to gauge the mental health of a given workforce other than, you know, the annual FEVS survey, which doesn't really get at that particular issue?
Sure. Well, I'd love to say yes, we could do that, you know, with some sort of survey or something, but we're always going to have those types of issues. I think really, if we take a look at the use of mental health services, if we take a look at the requests for those types of things, that's part of what we do in workforce operations is trying to identify sensors, markers, if you will, that maybe a work center could use some intervention at some point, because it's not just one person there. Maybe it's more than one. So one of the main keys is engaging leadership and being able to have conversations. We are working on building a culture of trust within this organization. And that's key to being able to have any of these types of conversations, building a place where the employees are okay with having conversations with management and leadership. That's how we're going to find out. Because quite frankly, we work in an organization where those individuals are not going to come forward, generally speaking, and say, hey, I want help. We are a workforce that helps others way more than we'll help ourselves.
And a final question. It sounds like there is a model for what you're doing in the military situation, where maybe they're a little further along in this type of effort.
Absolutely. So, like I said, I was a DoD guy prior to this, and this model is grown heavily in the military. There are other law enforcement agencies that have embedded mental health professionals. Many of those blend the role of operational psychologists and clinical psychologists. They're doing both. But yes, especially right now within the Army and the Marine Corps, embedding psychologists within units is kind of the model that they're using. The intelligence community is another one. So yes, we're blending a model that's already in existence and trying to adapt it for CBP purposes.
Dr. Joshua Tomchessen is an operational psychologist in the Workforce Operations Division at Customs and Border Protection. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies. And we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.